What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and man, I have another hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very prolific and gifted saxophonist who has collaborated and toured with some of the biggest names in the music industry, like Tina Marie, Anita Baker, Quincy Jones, and Whitney Houston. He is a musical genius and an innovator when it comes to composing, producing, and performing. Please put your hands together and welcome saxophonist, producer, and musician, Gerald Albright. How's it going, Gerald?
Excellent, Spud. How are you?
Oh, man, I'm doing great, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show and just, man, taking your time and chopping it up with me, man. It's an honor.
My pleasure, man. I appreciate that wonderful introduction, too. Thank you.
Oh, man, I got to bring you in right, man. You know, before we get into the questions, Gerald, I just want to talk about, man, my favorite track of all time that you've done. Now, it's from some of your older works, off your Grooveology CD, I would say back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't No Stopping.
Ah, okay. That's your favorite.
Oh, my God, man. You know, for me, as a producer and a keyboardist, you know, it had all of the personal elements that I feel that I use in my own compositions. You know, you're going to jump into the D minor scale, and then, man, when your change came in, you were doing a lot of the major 7/9 chords, and then you ended with the augmented chord progressions, and it was just so many elements, man. It's just truly innovative the way you compose and arrange your music.
Well, thank you for saying so. We had fun. That was actually a collaboration between myself and Jeff Lorber back in the day, and Jeff and I have done some fun music together, so I appreciate you saying that.
You know, I know you got this new release coming out, man, on June 15th, Pushing the Envelope. And, man, the guest appearances that you have on that album, from Fred Wesley to Earl Klug and Mr. George Duke, who I had the opportunity to interview a couple of months ago, man, was just a phenomenal experience as well. Tell me how you put this CD together.
Well, you know, for years, people have been trying to pigeonhole me into this, you know, the smooth jazz genre, which, of course, is a wonderful and viable genre. But, see, I came along in the mid-'80s with my record deal, when it was called Quiet Storm and basically contemporary jazz. So the way I approach the music is, in a general way, more with an R&B influence. You know, I'm a big James Brown fan, and I love the Philly International sound and the Motown sound. And so all that experience kind of comes through my productions and my songwriting. And what comes out is an edge, a little more edge than smooth jazz. So this particular project, we called it Pushing the Envelope because it's over and beyond the box of smooth jazz, if I can say that. And we didn't hold back on this one. We weren't thinking about formula. We just went with our heart and soul on this one, and just let it roll the way it rolls. So that's the project, basically.
It's good work, man. I had a chance to listen to the CD, and, man, the first track that really stuck with me is What Would James Do? That is a funky track, man.
Thank you. Thank you. I had the pleasure of writing and producing that, along with, you know, the rest of the album. I did all the writing, and I did a couple of cover tunes, which we can talk about later. But that particular tune, again, you know, getting back to my love of James Brown, I wanted to dedicate a song to James, and there was nobody else that could do that trombone solo but Fred Wesley, who spent, of course, many, many years with James Brown. And he just came and did a wonderful job, man, and I'm really happy with the way that particular tune came out.
Man. Now, how did you start in the business, Gerald? You know, from becoming a professional musician until your success that you have now, I mean, when did it really all begin for you and turn around?
Well, from 79 to 1987, I did a lot of studio work, and I still do. I still have clients that I work for, but I was in Los Angeles at the time, and that's when I got a chance to meet a lot of key people in the music industry. And in 1987, I was playing bass guitar and saxophone with Anita Baker. I was on the road with her for a couple of years. And Sylvia Roan, who at the time was with Atlantic Records, happened to be in the audience. And she was impressed with my playing. And after the show, she approached me and said, well, you know, I love the show and love your part of the show. And so what are you doing? Are you looking for a record deal? Have you done any demos? You know, just kind of general questions like that. And I said, well, you know, I have a few songs that I've kind of demoed, and you know, nothing has really come of it as of yet. And she said, well, I'd like to hear what you're doing. And long story short, we met in Los Angeles. She was in L.A. on a business trip, and I met with her, and she heard the songs and asked me, you know, what concept I saw for myself in terms of whatever that musical approach was for my vision as I did. And that's when I got my first record deal with Atlantic Records. And so from that point on, I've just been making CDs and touring around the globe, and it's been a real blessing for me.
Wow, there's a lot of success there. And, you know, a lot of people, I don't know, man, I don't think they know that you also play bass, you also play keyboards, and you also do a lot of drum programming, man. When did you really discover your gift to play all these instruments? Because I play multiple instruments as well. And, you know, I've been playing since I was, you know, very young, 14s when I started recording. When did you discover all of your talents and, you know, you were to translate those gifts into other instruments?
Well, I actually started playing saxophone when I was about 9 years old. And at that point, I just, you know, as a young kid, it was fun to just kind of blow through something and press the keys and produce a sound. And that's what caught my interest. Piano lessons, which wasn't as interesting for me, you know, just learning scales and stuff at that young age. So my private teacher, George Turple, sax at the age of 9, and I just loved it. And it was an instrument that I had the inclination to play. And so I played all through elementary school, junior high school, and college. And about 8 months after I graduated from college, I went on the road with Patrice Rushen, and you know, then everything just kind of started to snowball. So, but my interest, to answer your question, was way back when I was 9. So I've been in the music for quite a long time.
You know, it's funny, man, being a musician myself, and, you know, you too can understand, you know, being at a young age, and, you know, a lot of guys that are around you, you know, a lot of guys are into sports and things, but for me, it was all about demo tapes when I was 14 or 15. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not on the court, man. I'm in the studio and, you know, carrying my tapes around, making those demos. But, you know, music has always just been, like, my center focus, and I've always considered myself being a student of music, just still. I still remain a student just because of all the knowledge that you gain and meeting guys like you and just the experience that you have. It's like, man, I just have, you know, a long way to go in my journey, so...
Well, you know, we actually share that thought, man. I consider myself a student as well because, like you said, music is infinite, and there's no finishing point in learning music. I mean, there's always different evolutions of it, and even though I'm a professional musician, I always tell people that I'm still a student because you never get comfortable to the point to where you say you know everything about music that you need to know, because I don't think we'll ever reach that point in our lifetime.
Oh, I totally agree, man. I mean, most of the old masters that are great, they're usually much older.
Right. Exactly.
You know, because of your... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead. Make your point. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, because of your experience, man, you've been out for a long time. I mean, I consider you a veteran in the game, Gerald. I mean, you definitely have analog and DAW experience. Give me your pros and cons of, you know, both formats, merging from an analog format into a DAW world. And, you know, what are your pros and cons on both?
Well, you know, I basically still in my recording, and I'm about 14 CDs in now, I still use a combination of analog and digital formats. And I like them both for different reasons. I mean, I love the thickness of analog and the warmth that it brings. I mean, even, you know, in the age where we're using a lot of plugins in our softwares and stuff, I still lean toward the analog sound. But something has to be said for digital clarity and, you know, the authority that digital brings. And I think for me, at least, I know everybody hears differently, but the marriage between the two, namely analog and digital, is kind of like the winning combination for me because I hear things in a thick type of way. You know, when you go back to those old, you know, those old albums like we were talking about before, the Philly International sound, the Motown sound, all that stuff that was done on analog, it's just nothing like that sound and that thickness. So I couple it with the digital to develop my comfort zone.
Oh, I agree, man. You know, running those external pre's into the interfaces, you know, with some great converters, I mean, you're definitely capturing that warm sound. And there's still a lot of guys out there still use 2-inch tape, but I just find that, man, for editing sound and editing your tracks and vocals, I mean, having that digital format is just the only way to go, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And not even to talk about the storage space for analog tape now. I mean, I just don't have storage space for those 2-inch tape reels, man. It's better to have it in the hard drive versus having a big storage warehouse full of 2-inch analog tape.
Yeah, it's like having 15,000 phone books in a closet.
Exactly. Exactly.
I know that you use a lot of synthesizers, and you're a synthesized keyboard player also. What's your preference nowadays? I'm still a hardware fan, but within the last, say, 6 months, I've merged over into primarily a software synth type of tracking system on my Logic Pro. Are you using a combination of both, or are you strictly with hardware now?
Well, I use a combination of both. I mean, in my studio, I have a Yamaha XS8, and I still have an old D50 that I just love for certain layering type of effects.
Roland D50, oh yeah.
Yeah, and I still have a JD800, to couple with like horn sounds and stuff. The conventional stuff like the TR rack and the Motif rack and all that. But the soft synths are wonderful to use. I mean, they're easy access and they're very true sounding, and each generation of them, they just get better and better. And sometimes it's hard to tell, what's synthesized and what's real, So I use a combination of the two.
Yeah, it's been helpful to me. And for my sound, definitely thickening, especially when I try to do more live tracking, making it more sound like a band. But I'm really on the keys, just the library that I'm getting for Scarby Bass. I just want to talk about Scarby Bass, man. It's from Native Instruments, and they're recording and samples of their bass guitars, just probably the best I've heard on the market.
Wow.
I mean it spreads all across your keys, Gerald, and man, it sounds just like you got the bass from Chic, Nile Rodgers group, that bass guitar. I mean there's nice finger bass in cars, man. It just goes across the keys and it sounds phenomenal, man. You got to check it out.
I definitely will, and that's just a testimony to how technology has just really captured what a lot of these great artists have done in the past, man. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing.
Now, what DAW system are you on? Are you on Pro Tools? Are you running Logic or Cubase, Nuendo?
Well, I'm running a Digital Performer, and I've been a Performer guy for many years, and Digital Performer has really improved to be highly competitive with the other ones that you mentioned. And it's a thing where I just know the program so much that it's one of those things where I can just turn it on and work, as opposed to sitting at, with a 500-page owner's manual trying to figure out a new software.
Right.
And it does everything I need it to do in terms of the sounds, the plugins, the editing, and it's just very logical to use for me. So, and it's great for film work too. I know a lot of my buddies use it for film scoring and things like that. So I'm a Performer guy, man.
Oh, nice. No, that's a good stable system. I mean, hats off to Motu.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, to get your sound really thick, and we talked about sonically really making those instruments in your CD sound great, by the way.
Thank you.
What external mic pre's are you using for your recording and mastering?
Well, in my personal studio, I use a Demeter mic pre, which I've had for years, and I just like the way my saxophone sounds through it, and I run pretty much everything through it to create that warmth. And I have some Apogee hardware that I also use, and I'm a Shure endorser, so I have a lot of different Shure microphones that I use for my lead and background horns, the KSM-44 and the KSM-32. And if I need something in particular that I don't have in the studio, that's when I go elsewhere, and I can use my Neumann mics, or if I, have particular, mic pre's that I want to use that I don't have here in the studio, I'll just go to some others. But I find the comfort zone here, the advantage of having your home studio is that you can put the hours in to really get the sound the way you hear it, and not be on the clock, like you would in the commercial studio. So I'm enjoying the sound that I'm getting out of my studio now. So about 80 or 90% of what I do production-wise now is at home in my studio.
I agree, man. I mean, it's just, you know, 15 years ago, I probably wouldn't even be having this conversation with you. You know what I mean? Just
right.
Because from a consumer standpoint, man, we just didn't have access to really a lot of great quality equipment.
Right.
You know, but nowadays, man, converters are pretty decent. I mean, a lot of guys are running HD92s, and like you say, Apogee makes some great converters, the Rosetta 800, the Rosetta 200, and even their Apogee Ensemble racks. I mean, just the sound and the converters and the playback and everything is just phenomenal, and that's achievable for me.
Exactly. And it just allows you, you know, as you know, we're songwriters and producers in our own right, and sometimes you may get an idea at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning where you just can't run to a commercial studio and flip the switch. But if you have a home studio, you can just go downstairs and go to work. So it's nice to have that access 24/7 because you never know when the creative juices are going to flow.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of creative juices, man, I definitely want to talk about your compositions because to me, as an artist, as a producer, and as a musician, your arrangements and your progression is just the whole direction of your albums, Gerald, just takes me to another place and inspires me every time I hear it. I know you don't want to give all of your secrets away, man. You know, and there's really no way to really pinpoint creativity in the way it flows. But give me some of your methods on how you put your songs together for yourself and other artists that you produce.
Well, you know, it's basically a thing where I think the secret for me is that I really don't have a formula, and I allow the songs to come to me as they will. And sometimes it's a lyric, sometimes it's a melody, sometimes it's a drum beat, and other times, because I'm a bass player, I might take my bass guitar and hit a lick and go, okay, yeah, now I can develop something on this, and you know, let me see what I can do. So or sometimes I sit at the keyboard and just do a couple of chord progressions that feel nice and kind of develop it from there. So I just kind of allow get to hit me any way it wants to hit me, and then at that point I just kind of close myself up and start developing that given song. And I tell my wife that okay, I'm gonna be in here for a number of hours, just shoot the plate of food under the door and I'll see you later tonight, you know. But you know, it's just that commitment that helps to bring out the type of creativity that we do. And but most of the time it starts between, you know, like I said, the bass guitar, the keyboard, and my horn, you know, and between those three, I usually am able to at least launch a nice idea to develop. And from that point on, I just kind of start adding, you know, kind of painting the picture on the canvas and just, you know, developing that from, that initial idea.
Right, man. You know, I got a lot of the same foundations for tracking, man. I play bass also, and you know, I want to ask you, man, who's your inspiration for playing bass? I mean, I got a kind of, you know, about a good five of them I can name, but you know, who really inspires you on the bass?
Well, my first inspiration back in the day when I was in college was Louis Johnson.
Oh yeah, Brother Johnson. Oh yeah,
from the Brothers Johnson. Yeah, and I went to see them live in a performance not too far from the college that I attended. And he just blew me away. And at that time, he was playing a four-string precision bass. This is before he was playing the Music Man bass that, you know, that whose sound he's known for, you know.
Yeah.
And so after that concert, I said to myself that if I have to borrow a bass from somebody, I'm just going to borrow it and sit in my little dorm room and just learn a scale or two just to satisfy my own eagerness to learn the instrument. And that's what I did, and you know, one scale led to another, and I started to feel comfortable on it, and I started to, you know, play with a little band around the college area, you know, just to earn money for books and things like that, and soon after it became an integral part of my sound. And then at that point I was listening to a lot of other guys like Stanley Clarke, Marcus Miller, Anthony Jackson,
oh, yeah.
Freddie Washington, and then there were some guys when I lived in L.A., some in-town guys who were just great players. They may not have been real notable players or, you know, solo artists or famous in any way, but they were just great players. And I got, you know, little tidbits of you know, little clues on how to play and how to groove from those guys as well. So it was kind of a combination of all of those experiences.
Yeah, I agree, man. You named them all that I wanted. Only guy that you didn't name, he's really good. He's a newer guy, Victor Wooten.
Oh, I love Victor, man. Yeah, he's one of those phenomenons that you just sit back and you go, okay, he's kind of like the Michael Jordan of the bass player, man.
Oh,
it's just not too
God.
Many guys like him, you know?
Yes, I'm like, oh, man, make you want to hang your jersey up, man.
Exactly. Yes, indeed, man. Yeah, I know Victor very well, man, and the thing that makes him even more wonderful is that he's a great guy, and on top of all of the talent that he has, he's just a real laid-back brother that just has, you know, a God-given talent, and you got to appreciate that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, Gerald, finding that zone, man, to me, a zone as a musician, it's essential to have. I think everybody needs to be there at one point in their life and, you know, along their career. Do you find that on stage with the audience is energy, or being in a studio where you're a little bit more structured and you can really focus on the compositions?
Well, I think being in the zone occurs more for me in a live setting because of the spontaneity and just the oneness that you try to create with the audience. I've often described some situations that I've been through where I'd be playing, you know, front and center stage with my band, and then we just get into a groove that you almost lose yourself. And I kind of describe it as getting the spirit in church, you know, getting happy in church.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you just reach a plane where you almost forget that the audience is there, and you just kind of get into this groove that almost just levitates. And it's a great place to be, man, because you get a sense of completeness and euphoria that you don't get in a lot of other scenarios. And I mean, I've gotten that in the studio as well, in certain situations. But it's something about the live setting when the audience is pumped and the musicians behind you are pumped and the sound is good on stage, and there's just this synergy that's happening and evolving. And that's why we do what we do. I mean, we're messengers. It's our job for an hour or two to make people feel better than they did when they first walked into the venue, you know. And you never know who you're playing to. You're playing to folks who have hardships sometimes or just had a bad day, and they need that one song or that one show to just bring them to a smile and a place that just makes them feel happy. And that's what that's what God designed us to do, was to help people get to that space.
I totally agree with you. I've been playing for my church for 20 years as a music director and main keyboardist there. But, you know, I felt that my productions really changed is when I got into the live setting, you know, playing in front of an audience and, like you said, feeding off their energy of the band members and everybody in the congregation. And then I was able to bring that home with me and enter that in my production and my compositions. You know what I mean? And my groove was changing, my rhythm changed, my placements for chords and progressions change just because of playing with a band, you know what I mean? So I was really trying to get into more less MIDI sequence type of arrangements and more live playing. So I'm totally playing everything live all the way through my songs. That's if I'm playing it live now, instead of tracking and cutting and pasting things. I just get a better feel out of it that way.
Oh, it's nothing like that human element, man. And
yeah,
you know, when you're playing live on stage with guys who are supporting you and feeding you that energy, you know, that I just love my touring band because, you know, some nights they just throw stuff at me that I normally wouldn't hear. You know, they'll just turn the chord progression around or they'll change the beat, and that will inspire me to play something different in my own personal improvisation. And it just, you know, or I might throw a melody at the keyboard player, which will make him augment a chord that he normally wouldn't play in. So it's just
right.
This constant evolution, you know, we're just trying to bring all the pieces of the puzzle together, and it's a wonderful thing, and it's a challenge, you know.
It is.
Because you never know. I mean, you have the basic song rehearsed, but you never know, just based on the human element, when you put that into the equation, you don't know how the song is going to turn out.
Sure, but that's where jazz really starts, is that improv, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely, man, and that's why it's so infinite. You just never know where it's going to go and how you're going to end up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kirby Hancock had a documentary called Possibilities, man, and I always, you know, talk about that a lot just because of the possibilities where things can go in a live setting or in a studio. So, yeah, man, well said.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Herbie's another guy who's just phenomenal. I love him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, man, what is on the musical agenda for 2010, Gerald? I mean, what's on the plate?
Well, just ultimately being excited about this new CD project. Again, it's called Pushing the Envelope, and it's coming out June 15th. It's my 14th CD, and I'm going to be going out with a wonderful tour called Guitars and Saxes, and it's four different artists, myself, Kirk Whalum, Jeff Golub, and Peter White. And we're going to tour the country for as long as it takes, you know, to cover the ground that we need to cover and have some fun. And so we'll be promoting the album on that particular tour, and then I'm going to be doing some of my own dates and, you know, probably go back. I just came back from Japan about a month ago, and we did very well there. And I want to go to Europe and really start touring there extensively. And also producing a record on my daughter, who is a phenomenal singer. She's actually on my new project singing background on a couple of songs, but she's a great lead vocalist, and she has a tune out called You and I, which we co-wrote and I produced for her, and it's on a project called New Jazz, and it can be downloaded on iTunes, and it's doing very, very well for her. So we're trying to get her an official record deal by the end of the year. So there's a lot going on, Spud, and hopefully all of this will come to fruition, and you know, we'll get into 2011 and then raise the roof on that year too.
Oh man, you know? That sounds like a plan to me. Well, Gerald, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, man. It's truly an honor, man. I mean, hope one day when we could get together and jam it out.
It would be great. I look forward to meeting you and hearing your fine music as well, man. Thank you for your support.
Oh, man, I'm always going to be a dedicated fan, man. You got me, so.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, well, you take it easy and have a great year, man.
You too. All the best.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And a big shout-out and thank you to Mr. Gerald Albright for coming on my show and chopping it up with me, man, one-on-one. I'm a huge fan of Gerald's. I've been a big fan of his for a long time, man, and, you know, just to get that musical side of him, what he does on his own time when he writes and composes his music, man, was truly an inspiration to hear, just because we share so many of the same traits as musicians, man, and, you know, he still remains a student of music. You know, it's just amazing for me to hear that, man, somebody at his level of musicianship, man, and, you know, it's just another proof to show you, man, it is endless of where you can go musically, man. It takes years and years of study and listening and fine-tuning that ear, man, just to be able to blend in any situation as a musician, to be able to play with anybody and just to be as versatile as you can be. That's the ultimate goal to me as a musician, producer, composer, and even an artist, a songwriter. The possibilities are endless. So again, man, big shout out to Gerald Albright, man. And for more information on Gerald, you need to check out his website at www.geraldalbright.com. And again, that's www.geraldalbright.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up as well at www.myspace.com/Spud's New Zone. Again, that's www.myspace.com/Spud's New Zone. And I'm also available on iTunes as a podcast. So if you're on your computer, if you have an iPhone, go to the iTunes store and type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight and under the podcast and click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And for questions and suggestions, you can also hit my email up at spudtootight@gmail.com. And for the remainder of the show, man, I'm going to let the track play out. And the title of the track is called Found the Clue, and it's by Mr. Gerald Albright. So until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.
Mm-hmm.